Welcome everybody out tonight to the meeting of the Northern Regional Advisory Council. I'm Robert Burns and I'm the chairman. We'll start with introductions. Jim, if you'd...
I'm Jim Gaskill from South Weber and I'm at large.
Craig Van Tassel from Camas and I'm sportsman.
John Leonard, I'm from North Ogden and represent Sportsman.
John Blazard from Camas, representing Agriculture.
Russ Lawrence from Ogden, representing Public at Large.
Bryce Thurgood, Perry, Utah, I represent at large.
John Wall from Riverdale, Public at Large.
Jeffrey Hicks, South Weber, at large.
Paul Cowley, representing the Forest Service.
I'm Justin Doling. I'm the regional supervisor and serve as the executive secretary of the council, and I'm a non-voting member.
And again, I'm Robert Burns. I represent the public at large. I'd like to also recognize Ernie Perkins and Bill Fenimore, representing the Northern Region on the Wildlife Board. The purpose of the RAC is to gather public input on concerning wildlife management policy and rules and regulations. Then the council makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board sets policy for all protected wildlife in Utah. If you join me in turning your cell phones to vibrate or turn them off, we could have a nice uninterrupted meeting. When speaking, if you'd please come up to the microphone, we have one here in the center. Our meeting is recorded, so we can get it transcribed, and you can also go online if you'd like and listen to the meeting. I use it often when I'm checking the minutes. And that's usually the quickest way to check some information if you want, because our minutes sometimes won't be out for a while. Our procedure, we will have a presentation on each agenda item. After the presentation, we'll have questions from the public, then we'll have questions from the RAC. Then if you would like to make comments on the agenda item, if it is an action item, please fill out a blue card, bring them up, then we can call you up in turn. If you're making comments for a group, you can have 5 minutes. If you're making comments for yourself, it'd be 3 minutes. Paul Cowley, to my left, we'll have a stopwatch, and he'll try to give you a little high sign if you're getting close to your time. After comments from the public, we go to comments from the RAC. When the public comments are completed, that's the end of the public participation on that agenda item. And we'll have comments from the RAC. Then we'll have motions from the RAC. We might deliberate on the motions, and then we'll have a vote. With that, we do have a request to amend the agenda. I emailed out that information to you. So when we have our motion for the accepting the agenda, if you care to, make sure you amend that for the coyote control program presentation and the Houndsman's request to have a few minutes talking about something they'd like to propose on cougars. Seeing that, the chair would accept a motion to adopt the agenda or the amended agenda as you see fit.
I would so move.
To adopt the agenda amendment? Yes. Amended agenda?
Amended agenda.
Okay. I'll second that.
I think I had one on. Craig, or was that Jim? Craig? Okay. So. Okay. We have a motion to adopt the amended agenda. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Passes unanimously. I emailed the minutes out to you a little late, but I hope you had time to go through them. I did make some changes for clarity there. Are there any additional changes to the minutes?
I'll move that we accept the minutes as adjusted by the chair.
We have a second from Russ. So we have a motion to approve the minutes of our prior meeting as amended. All in favor, say aye and raise your hand, please.
Aye.
It's unanimous. I did email you out the Wildlife Board meeting update. Are there any additional questions on that? Okay, with that, we'll go to Justin for the regional update.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just want to touch base on some of our sections and let you know what's going on. We are in the middle of a pretty good drought, and I think here in the northern part of the state, conditions aren't as bad as we're seeing elsewhere in the state, so that's a little good news. But as a result of that drought, we've had several small fires. Not near the scale that they've had in the central region or in the southeastern region, but in West Box Elder, we've had several small fires that have ranged anywhere from 700 to 3,000 acres. And so our habitat section has been meeting with the Bureau of Land Management to try to evaluate those fires and see if we can't get some rehab work going there, get some seeds into the ground before winter to get that range back into condition. Our habitat section has also finished up a project on Rock Creek, which is at Hardware Ranch, and they've went in and rehabbed a pretty good section of stream there. It's a small stream, but you'd be surprised how many fish you can actually catch out of that stream, and they've done a real nice job there. If you want to watch a little bit about that, you can go to the Adam Eagle show, and he did a spot, I believe, on the 21st of July. So our aquatic section is keeping an eye on our conservation pools. We have several conservation pools where we've acquired the base of the reservoir so that it can provide water for oversummering fish. So we're keeping our eye on that and making sure that those conservation pools don't get tapped into. Our aquatic staff is also busy doing cutthroat surveys and a few reservoir surveys. They have plans to treat the right-hand fork of the Logan River. It's part of the Bonneville cutthroat recovery effort, and so they'll be using rotenone there. The goal there is to treat. It's a two-day project. Would be September 18th through the 19th. So if there's any RAC members that want to go up and kind of watch that effort, I'd encourage you to contact Craig Skalgard, our aquatic manager. As far as fishing, the reports are that porcupine is good fishing for kokanee right now. They're running a little bit small, but the fishing's really good there. And they tell me that the wiper boil should be starting up at Willard any day now. So if you like to fish wipers out at Willard, that should be picking up. For the wildlife section, we've launched this new program, this coyote control program, and John Shivik will give us an update this evening about that, so I won't go too much into too much detail there. But the droughts have increased the amount of big game depredation we're seeing, particularly in West Box Elder and Rich County. So it's keeping our landowner specialists pretty busy and our biologists fairly busy, either arranging depredation hunts to try to minimize the impacts to those agricultural fields or hazing animals out of those fields. The section is starting to work on the mule deer unit management plans. So if any of the RAC members have an interest in particular units, the biologists will be formulating ideas and thoughts and developing those plans. So I'd encourage you to get a hold of either Randy Wood or Darren DeBlois and get plugged into the appropriate biologist there to talk to. Most of our biologists are reporting that they're seeing a fair number of small bucks this year, which is probably a result of good production last year, a fairly mild winter, and very little mortality. So that's good news. From our outreach section, as a result of going to this 30-unit management structure, our dedicated hunter participation has dropped again. We had about 1,700 new dedicated hunters sign up for the program during this last application period. And right now we're about 57% below the peak we had about 4 years ago. So our 100%, our dedicated hunter participation is kind of on a little bit of a slide. I hope people are just kind of sitting back and kind of waiting to see what this 30-unit structure brings, and hopefully they're encouraged to get back into that program because we rely pretty heavily on them for volunteer service hours. From our law enforcement section, they ran a very successful quagga muscle roadblock up at Echo last weekend. To give you a comparison, they did this a year ago, and they checked about 30 boats. This year, they checked over 120 boats and actually were able to decontaminate a boat that came from an infected water, I believe, in Wisconsin. So it was a busy afternoon. They checked a lot of boats, and it was a good way to kind of get the word out to the public that really, if we're going to fight this war on quagga mussels, it all comes back to the user and their willingness to keep their boats decontaminated and follow those three principles of drain, dry, and flush before you go out on the reservoirs. So that's going on in the law enforcement world. The other thing is they did get together the other day, and their intention is to continue with these big game winter range patrols where they're looking for illegal activities on big game winter range, primarily the poaching of mule deer. And so they have plans underway to continue that effort. And again, I would encourage any of the RAC members that want to get out for an evening patrol to contact either Scott Davis or Mitch Lane and get signed up for that. It can be a little boring at times, but sometimes it gets pretty exciting. So that's all I have, unless you have questions.
No questions on Justin's presentation. John, we'll go ahead with Bobcat harvest recommendations.
I'm running here. Good.
John, while you're setting up,
sure, thank you.
Bruce and Joel, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourselves since you're here.
I'm Joel Ferry, representing agriculture.
Bruce Silito, representing Bureau of Land Management.
Thank you.
Thank you. Looks like we're up and running.
Are
we good? Okay. Not accustomed to being this close. Looks like that's. Let's see if this is working okay. Something's acting kind of strange with that picture, but it should be all right. I'd like to present the Bobcat recommendations for this year, 2012-2013, from the plan. It's something that's it's one of our more simple plans. We look at Bobcats every year, and we compare what the data are for our current year, our last harvest, to what we've had in the past, to this target range for some of these different variables. And these variables are called our performance targets. The first variable is proportion of kittens and yearlings. What this is the out of the harvest, the number of animals that have been harvested and brought in and checked in. We look at the proportion that are kittens, proportions that are adults, or, you know, out of the kittens and yearlings out of the total number of animals. We look at adult survival. Adult survival is something we can calculate once we get the ages and the sexes of the animals over the last couple of years. We can calculate the survival rate, which is, you know, if it's 70% or 0.7, it means that in any given year, 7 out of 10 animals would survive to go on to the next year. Percent females, again, this is really the proportion of females, number of females in the out of 100 that have been harvested. And then set days per bobcat. And the set days per bobcat is one of the more the complicated ones in the sense that that's done with surveys. We survey the trappers, ask them how many traps they put out, how many nights they put those traps out for, and that's how we calculate the set days per bobcat. So if one guy set out 10 traps for 10 days, that would be 100 trap nights. And if he caught five bobcats, that would be five bobcats per 100 trap nights. So that's how that's calculated. Then each of these variables, we have a target range. We know historically from the back towards the 1980s, we've got this confidence interval on our on each one of these. And so what we try to do is make sure that each one of these variables comes in every year for kittens and yearlings between this 0.42 and 0.56, adult survival between 6.65 and 0.72, females 0.41 to 0.45, and the set days per bobcat, 197, which actually is the range on that is 171 to 220. I put the mean down there. So that's what we're going for. The performance targets then for this year, or what we actually saw in actual data, kittens and yearlings at 0.35, adult survival at 0.7, and then females at 0.45 is that proportion, and set days per bobcat, 400. So relative to targets, this is really, some things came through kind of different on this presentation. But we're still okay. Relative to the targets, proportion kittens and yearlings, that's a little low. Adult survival turned out perfect, right in there where it's supposed to be. Females, right in there where it should be. And then set days per bobcat is a lot higher than the target's supposed to be. So two out of those four are out of where there's we want them. So according to the plan outlines very specific steps depending on how many variables are in or out of those guidelines and tells us what we can adjust in terms of permit numbers or season dates. And what we fall into this time is if any two performance targets are outside of the range, you would adjust the number of tags per individual by one or two. However, this is this language that was added last year, which is to keep the number of tags consistent with the previous year if the variables are moving in the right direction. So that is, if the management we used the year before, that the animals are still responding appropriately, moving in the right direction, then we'll just kind of hold our course. So what we have to do then is look at our 2011 data. And if we go back and look at that, you can see it was lower in 2001, higher in 2012, so we're moving in the right direction. They're all good, survival and females. They're still in the range both years. And then set days per bobcat was a lot higher, now down to 400. So that's moving in the right direction too. So all of our variables are moving in the right direction, even the ones that are out. And so what this dictates for us to do is to maintain consistency with the previous year. And what we are recommending is that we keep the maximum number of permits capped at 4,600. And limit of three permits per individual. If you were to go look at last year's guidebook and compare it to the guidebook that we're recommending this year, they'll look exactly the same in terms of permits, numbers, and season lengths. Even the seasons are about the same. We just have to adjust. I just adjust the dates so they start on the same day of the week as they did the previous year, so we don't end up opening on a Sunday or something like that. But other than that, everything's exactly the same as the previous year, and it's fairly simple and straightforward. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, John. Do we have any questions from the public? Comments, yeah. Seeing none, questions from the council? Oh, if you have a question, I need you to come up to the microphone, please. State your name.
My name's Becky Wood. I'm actually on the agenda to discuss something else, but I'm just curious. I've only ever seen one bobcat in my whole life in the mountains of this area. I'm just curious if you have an estimate how many bobcats are really out there. Thank you.
Yeah, no, and that's a good and very common question. A lot of the species that we manage are bears or cougars or bobcats or things that are very rare for people to ever see. And so we don't have a good estimate of exactly how many there are, and I try to get away from that. And that's why we use these proxy numbers. We know very well, especially with things like cougars, bears, bobcats, the proportion of females, things like that, really helps to drive a population, whether it's going up or down. So we don't know exactly what the population is, but we can tell from these indices if it's doing this or this or this. And right now, based on the numbers that we're looking at, it's probably, well, from your perspective, that stable to maybe rising a little bit, but I can't tell you exactly how many there are.
Questions from the council? John.
Now, on your surveys, does that include guys that bought a fur bearer's license, or is that just trappers?
It's the fur bearer license.
Okay. Yes, sir.
John, on your variable for kittens and yearlings, that's the proportion in the harvest, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And so as that number goes up, does that tell us we're having good reproduction? Or what does that variable tell us as it changes?
The way I looked at that for proportions, kittens and yearlings, I looked at it more the other way around, where, let me think about this for a second. We want to see more, you want to see a higher number. Right, think about it. If you have a lower number, you're harvesting less, so you'd want to back away from the permits because you want to see a higher proportion, which would indicate that you've got a growing population and more of those guys in the population. That would be the interpretation, basically just what you said. Okay. So as you get more of those, there's more of them in the population, and if you have more of the lower age groups, that's an indicator that your population is growing.
Okay.
And if you have fewer, it's an indication that it's not growing, right? So alternatively. All these things have a variety of different, they're not perfect. That's why we use four of them. Any one of them doesn't tell you everything about a population, but the four of them together helps to tell you a lot better. For instance, things like set days per bobcat is heavily influenced by the number of inexperienced trappers that are out there versus experienced trappers. And you get a lot more inexperienced trappers when the previous year pelt price is very high. So for that reason, we look at each one of these, and these are good indicators of effort, good indicators of the health of the population, but any one of them isn't perfect, and that's why we take all four of them together. And that was way too wordy of a response. But
no, but it's good. That's, I think, why we really like the newer plan.
Thank you. So,
Paul.
How many animals were harvested last year?
Last year, let's see, 846 trap, 156 non-trap. And that's right in around the average over since 79 is right around 1,500. And that's around, what is that, 1,000 or so?
Thank you.
John Blaser.
So the non-trapped would be houndsmen?
Non-trapped would be houndsmen, shooters, shooting, any other kind of take like that.
Do you see any advantage to having a certain number of the tags allocated to houndsmen rather than first-come, first-served trappers? I just hear a lot of houndsmen complaining to me that the trappers are taking all the bobcats and they don't ever get a chance to chase them, and they don't ever kill the babies, they only kill the big ones.
So. Yeah, I'll take that under note. I haven't heard that. I talk with the houndsmen quite a bit. I haven't heard that one in particular. I think, you know, it's like a lot of our other issues where it's, we've got to figure out amongst all the groups, have to figure out within themselves and between each other how to share the mountain. So I'd be resistant of allotting certain numbers to certain groups. I kind of like that idea of letting everybody, so the democratic way, and letting everybody have at it versus complicating it that much more. If it became a huge issue, we might approach it differently, but I think we're handling it pretty well the way it is right now.
Any additional questions from the council? Seeing none, we'll go to the public for comment. We have one card, Stan Bassett.
My name is Stan Bassett, and I'm representing the Utah Trappers Association, and we would like to support the recommendations that have been presented tonight.
Thank you, Stan. Any additional comments from the public on this topic? Be sure you amend your blue card.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to say the Utah Houndsman Association also supports the division proposal on the Bobcats.
I'll change it on your card for you. I'll change it. I'll get it. Okay.
Robert.
Yes. Chet Young. Any additional comments from the public on this agenda item? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Any comments before we move on to a motion? John, where are we at in our cycle on this? Have we had this for 2 years now, this current Bobcat plan?
This current plan is from 2007 to 2016. But the recommendations come out every year for Bobcat. And it's a little different. Our bear, cougar, those guys have gone to a 3-year cycle. The plans are still, there's still decade-long plans, but the recommendations for those are every 3 years. Bobcat's still on the 1-year recommendation cycle.
Okay. We adopted this management plan that long ago? Doesn't seem like that long ago.
Because I think you discussed it last year, an amendment to it last year to add that language that said if things are stable, then to keep consistent with the previous year. So
okay.
You probably remember it from fairly recently.
All right. Thank you. Jim Gaskell.
Yeah, I'd just like to say it's refreshing to be sticking to the plan. And with that in mind, I'll make a motion that we accept the recommendations on the Bobcat harvest for 2012-2013.
I'd second that.
We have a motion from Jim Gaskell and a second from Paul Cowley. If I could paraphrase, recommend the Wildlife Board adopt the Bobcat harvest recommendations as presented. Is that acceptable?
Yep.
Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we'll have a vote. All in favor, please say aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
It's unanimous. Blair, we'll go ahead and do the waterfowl guidebook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the RAC. Tonight I'll be presenting the waterfowl recommendations for the 2012 and 2013 season. And in order to formulate these regulations, there's two specific surveys that we look to each year conducted by the Fish and Wildlife Service. One of those is a habitat survey. It's a count of the May ponds and the prairie pawl regions in North America. And essentially what that is a measure of the amount of habitat available to reproducing waterfowl. The second survey is a waterfowl breeding pair count. And what that is the number of breeding pairs of waterfowl in that same region. And that gives an idea of the number of pairs we have that will be reproducing for the current waterfowl season. Based upon those two surveys, I just wanted to summarize some of the data that we received for this year. Overall, compared to last year, water was a lot less abundant across that region. Water was down, but overall, compared to the long-term average, it's similar to where we've been in the past, and so it's nothing to really be too concerned about. I'm really just a little bit drier than it has been last year. The number of geese that we saw this year was up from last year, and that is partly because it was a little bit warmer and a little bit drier this year, and so we didn't lose as many nests to flooding as we did last year. Compared to our long-term average, we are a little bit lower on geese in Utah and similar in the flyway, but nothing to really be too concerned about. For our swan surveys, we do two important surveys each year. One of them is a mid-winter survey. And on that, we were up from last year and above our long-term average. There's also a survey that's done in Alaska for swans, and both of those were up as well. And so it's a good indication our swan populations are doing really good. For duck populations, I wanted to touch on just a couple of species here. First is the mallards. Our flyway package each year is based upon the mallard population. This year was up again from last year and above the long-term average, and so that's an indication that overall duck populations are doing well because we use mallards as an index to overall all populations of waterfowl, or of ducks, that is. A few species that we've been concerned about in the past, and the first one is pintails. They were down again as compared to last year and still below their long-term average. It could be somewhat misleading this year because as conditions are drier in the prairie pottle regions, pintails tend to go farther north to nest, and so we may have just missed some of those in our surveys this year, but overall, pintail numbers are lower than they have been historically. Camasbacks were similar to last year and continue to increase, and so there's the possibility that in the future, next few years, you may be able to see an increase to the camasback bag. Scop are one of the success stories we've seen in the last several years. They have been down the last decade, but continue to increase the last several years. And they're actually to the point now that we can actually increase the number of days in harvest, which I'll talk about in just a minute. Redhead numbers are similar to last year and are above their long-term average as well. And they're an important species here. We do have a lot of redheads that breed in the Great Salt Lake region. So overall, duck numbers are up a little bit from last year and are above their long-term average. Like I discussed a minute ago, the mallard populations. Based on our population, the Fish and Wildlife Service has allowed us to have a liberal harvest package this year. And what that means is we can have the maximum season length and the maximum bag again. So that gives us an opportunity to hunt waterfowl for 107 days and have a bag of 7 birds. There are several species that are a little more restricted. The first one's pintail. It allows us to have a 107-day season, but we do have a reduced bag of 2. Camasback is a 107-day season with a bag of 1. And scop, which is the increase this year from 86 days, goes up to 107 days. And the bag will increase to 7 this year for our recommendation. As far as the dates for the waterfowl season, the duck, coot, and merganser season will begin October 6th and run to the 19th of January statewide. The bag will be 7 total and 14 in possession, include no more than 2 hen mallards, 2 pintails, 2 redheads, and 1 camasback per day. And the coot bag is 25 in possession. The goose season in the northern zone will begin on October 6th and run to January 19th. Outside of that zone, it will begin on the 6th of October and run to October 18th with a partial break there and resume on the 27th of October and end on January 27th. And the bag will be 3 daily and 6 in possession. For the light goose season, the northern zone begins on October 27th and runs to January 19th with a break and then resumes again on the 18th of February and runs till the 10th of March. Outside of that zone, it begins on October 16th and runs to January 19th and then resumes again on March 1st through the 10th. The light goose bag is 10 daily and 20 in possession. For our snipe season, it'll begin on October 6th and run to January 19th. That's a daily bag, daily of 8 and 16 in possession. Swan season will be on October 6th through December 9th, and that is only in the Great Salt Lake hunting area like it's been in the past, and we'll recommend 2,000 permits again this year. Our falconry season is October 6th through 19th, and that's 3 daily and 6 in possession. And the youth waterfowl hunt will be on September 22nd, which is 2 weeks prior to the opening of the general duck season. For shooting hours, we do recommend a later opening in several of these counties in the northern region. That's Box Elder, Salt Lake, Davis, Weber, and Cache. And that's largely due to just the large number of waterfowlers that we have in those areas. So we'd like it to be a little bit lighter for safety reasons. The rest of the state will be a half hour before sunrise on the opener. And for the rest of the season will begin half hour before sunrise and a half hour after sunset. There are the possibility of some waterfowl management areas up here that could be closed due to Phragmites burns. This is an invasive species that we're fighting along the shores of the Great Salt Lake. And so we would be burning Phragmites out there, possibly. And so if that does occur, we'll use the proper media outlets to try to post that information and give as much notice as possible. The other specific recommendation to the northern region is the Antelope Island Causeway issue. And this was brought to the RAC last year with a conflict between the different user groups. Randy Berger from the northern region was the one who took on this issue and met with several of the different constituents and people who had a vested interest in this. He met with the state parks people, with hunting groups, as well as some of our non-consumptive users. And they came to a consensus that the best way to tackle this issue would just be to establish a 600-foot buffer on both sides of the road that we get on the fee side by the fee booth and run to the island. That will help to accommodate people who want to go out there and travel the causeway safely and to view birds. Also allows hunters to hunt in that general vicinity, just not within that 600 buffer zone along the causeway. That concludes the recommendations. I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the public on Blair's presentation? Seeing none. On the Antelope Island Causeway buffer, have you defined where it starts? Is it the center line of the road? Is it the edge of the pavement?
We've defined it as the edge of the pavement, so okay. It'd be 600 feet from the edge of the pavement north and 600 feet from the edge of the other side of the pavement south.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure you have that specific wording in there.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Other questions from the council? Jim Gaston?
Maybe I heard incorrectly, but I thought you said that it closed a half an hour after sunset. Is that
yes.
correct?
Yeah.
That's a big change from the past.
Is that not similar to what we've done in the past?
It's always been sunset.
Oh, has it?
Well, all my life. I thought that was a federal regulation.
And yeah, you are correct.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I'd go for it if it was a half an hour after, but I'd...
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure we all would.
Jeffrey.
Go for the closest one. I want to ask a question about the scop harvest.
Okay.
This year it's a big increase from the year before. And also, when you listed it on your page, it had an asterisk by it. Is there something more that we need to know about that? Or?
No, it was just to highlight that it had changed from last year to this year. So.
And do you know the percentage of increase? I mean, I think last year it was just a couple. Probably guys out here would know. Three?
Yeah.
3 to 7? That's big. So was it a huge increase in nesting? Or?
Yeah, what it is it's based on the models that are formulated by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And they have specific criteria in that plan that if the population reaches a certain level, then we can become more liberal with our harvesting season. And so the way that's set up is that the most restrictive would be a bag of two in 86-day season. The next step up would be 86 and a bag of three. After that, it would be 107-day season and a bag of seven. And so as far as Utah is concerned, I mean, scop make up a relatively small portion of our bag. And so, you know, it is something to consider on a flyway-wide basis rather than just a statewide basis. But Fish and Wildlife Service is comfortable with it being at that level, and so we're comfortable with it as well.
Bryce?
On the pintails, is most other states around or in the flyway at the 2 pintail bag limit, or are we higher?
Yeah, 2 is the maximum that the Fish and Wildlife Service will allow us to take. And so we're hanging right there until they allow us to take more.
Well, I mean, dropping it from 2 to 1 is obviously you're worried about the levels keep going down, right?
Yeah, we were recommending a 2 this year. It's really based upon another model the Fish and Wildlife Service has and how many they'll allow us to harvest. With the population being down, it's still not at a level that they're concerned that we would over-harvest pintails. And so that's why they've allowed us to have the 107-day season in a bag of 2 again this year.
Okay. I just seen it. I thought it was the only one below the long-term average.
Oh, yeah, it is below the long-term average. It's not significantly below, and it really just depends on the year for pintails. I mean, they're up and down. They are down below their long-term average, but not at a place where, you know, we feel like we need to reduce that bag further than 2.
Jim?
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about our local conditions? I know all of these regs are based on things that don't, we don't have any pond survey of any significance. So could you tell us a little bit how it's looking? Have we got any botulism problems or any of that kind of thing going on?
Yeah, if you compare it to last year, it's probably night and day. I mean, last year we had a huge amount of water, a lot of snowpack. And this year it's about complete opposite. We're really dry. A lot of our water is shrinking. We are able to manage that within our waterfowl management areas, and so we can maintain, for the most part, our water levels. But overall, the Great Salt Lake, it's drying up really fast right now. And so as far as botulism, we haven't seen many outbreaks yet on the Great Salt Lake. We expect that there will be some, because there's always some every year. It's just a matter of how long these conditions persist. If it maintains to a really high temperature as well as the water level is really low. If that water temperature increases to a point, bacteria produces a toxin which, when ingested, causes botulism. And so we're monitoring that. We've seen some outbreaks in ponds in the Great Salt Lake area, but nothing yet in the Great Salt Lake. But I would imagine there will be some before things cool down.
Thank you.
Any additional questions from the council?
Got one question, Robert.
Joel.
Blair, thank you for all the work you've been doing in this new job. On the swans, I've heard that on our swan population through our flyway that it's been, you know, growing and it's quite large. Is there any talk of increasing those permits at all, or do you know what the population numbers are for the swans and what kind of situation are we in there?
I don't know if I have swans specifically. Let's see. So I don't have that number here with me, but...
Okay. I mean, I've heard that they, kind of like the snow geese, they're eating themselves out of house and home in their nesting grounds. Have you seen that?
No, swans haven't really been the same as the snow geese.
They're not those kind of numbers? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, swans, they are increasing. They're not to a point where we are increasing permits yet, mm-hmm. though, but, I mean, it may be a possibility in the future if they continue to do well, because they have done really well the last several years.
Okay. And you don't know what our flyway populations are?
I don't. I don't have that number. Okay. Actually, sorry about that.
Just be interesting to know. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any additional questions from the council? Seeing none, we'll go to comments from the public on the agenda item. Carl Ingwell.
Hey, guys. Good evening. Thank you for letting me speak tonight. I'm from the Utah Birders, and we just wanted to say that we are in support of the guidelines proposed tonight, most notably the rule change concerning the 600-foot buffer along the Antelope Island Causeway. Thanks.
Thank you, Carl. Any additional comments from the public on this agenda? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Jeff.
How come I don't get my own microphone?
Because you're sitting next to Paul.
That wasn't the question part. Sorry.
Someday.
I just wanted to make a comment about the 600-yard buffer zone. And Blair mentioned Randy Berger on this, and I want to thank Randy because he kind of stepped into a little bit of a quagmire, what we thought might be a quagmire, but it turned out really well, and he mediated it nicely. And that 600-foot buffer turned out to be an okay thing for everybody, including the hunters who were a little concerned at first, and the birders. So it worked out well, and thanks to the DWR and Randy and Mr. Ingwell and everybody that worked to come up with a good, you know, a good compromise that covers safety and also allows us still to not lose any real hunting opportunity. So thanks.
Any additional comments from the council? Seeing none, chair would entertain a motion. Paul.
I'd move that we therefore accept the guidebook as presented.
I second that.
We have a motion from Paul Cowley and a second from John Wall to recommend the Wildlife Board adopt the waterfowl guidebook and rule R657-09. Is that acceptable, Paul?
That is, yeah.
Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, we'll have a vote. All in favor, please say aye and raise your hand.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? It's unanimous in favor. Thank you, Blair. You're probably up next. Great Salt Lake Waterfowl Management Area Management. Waterfowl Management Area Management Plan.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tonight I'll be presenting this plan, which is developed for our waterfowl management areas along the Great Salt Lake. It is a 5-year plan, which would begin this year and run to 2017. The purpose of this plan was a need to balance several different issues that were occurring along Great Salt Lake. One of those was a need from the hunting public. They were interested in how we were managing the Great Salt Lake and wanted to be a little more involved in that management process. And we also had some concerns with the ecosystem of the Great Salt Lake, and so we wanted to formulate a committee that could come together and address some of these issues. And so our committee was formed, consisted of sportsmen, conservation organizations, airboat, mudboat, and motorist users, guides and outfitters, as well as personnel from our waterfowl management area. And I wanted to just highlight some of the goals and objectives and strategies within this plan, just to give you an idea of what the committee came up with and some of the ideas that they had. The first goal was a conservation outreach and education goal, and the objective was to increase waterfowl awareness and understanding through 2017. In order to accomplish this, we wanted to survey hunters about their level of understanding about issues surrounding waterfowl on the Great Salt Lake. There's a lot of different issues that could potentially occur on the Great Salt Lake and are occurring on the Great Salt Lake. So we wanted to get a level of understanding that our hunters have of our waterfowl management and waterfowl issues. We also wanted to provide more information to the general public and hunters on bird identification, waterfowl management area maps, overall management, and any other information that may be pertinent to help people to understand more about waterfowl management and waterfowl in general. Second goal is a hunter retention and recruitment goal, and the objective is to increase waterfowl hunters statewide by 6,500 through 2017. In order to accomplish this, we want to continue to support hunting workshops and events that are put on for our youth, as well as support our DWR law enforcement youth hunt mentoring program, and just promote any other waterfowl opportunities through our social media networks, which are becoming a good avenue for us to recruit people and provide information to them. Third goal is operation and maintenance goal. Our objective is to maintain funding for wetland management and expand management capacity through 2017. We rely really heavily on our volunteers along the Great Salt Lake. We want to continue to provide opportunities for them and find ways of increasing opportunities as they present themselves. We also want to look for opportunities to partner with our sportsmen's groups on different projects along the Great Salt Lake, as well as generate a list of projects where special funding could be utilized. Occasionally we do come up with additional funding, and it'd be nice to have a list of priorities that we could direct that funding to and get some of the projects accomplished that we would like to. The fourth goal is a habitat management goal, and the objective is to improve habitat quality and quantity through 2017. One of the biggest problems we're facing as far as habitat and overall issues on the Great Salt Lake is the spread of Phragmites. We want to continue to aggressively manage the spread of that plant. We have a really good Phragmites management plan that Randy Berger developed. It's in place. We want to follow that and continue to try to eradicate as much of this plant as possible. We also want to manage our water levels to maximize our habitat productivity. Largely things like botulism, as well as just overall habitat quality, can be greatly impacted or hindered based on water management. And so we want to continue to maximize the water that we have and manage those levels appropriately. We also want to develop water management plans for our WMAs, as well as mitigate any impacts to wetlands that could be occurring around the Great Salt Lake. The last goal is a hunt management goal. We want to maintain high-quality hunting opportunities through 2017. We do this by expanding hunter access to our WMAs as well as the Great Salt Lake, establish rest areas where appropriate, provide opportunities for hunters with disabilities, as well as monitor hunter satisfaction and crowding issues. This is something that we've done in the past. We want to continue to be aware of where waterfowl hunters stand, if they're having satisfaction issues, if things are hindering their satisfaction, as well as just monitor crowding. We do have some triggers in place that if these satisfaction and crowding surveys do fall below a certain level, then we'll look at ways that we could possibly improve satisfaction and crowding. There are also some specific recommendations that were put forward by the group that they would like to see the area managers consider. And that's to establish more smaller impoundments, acquire new lands when possible, repair old dikes, and establish rest areas at the discretion of the WMA managers. And that just is a good summary of the plan, and take any questions you guys may have on it.
Thank you, Blair. Any questions from the public on the presentation? Seeing none, questions from the council? Jim?
Do we have any
any data to support the widely held notion that youth hunts really do help recruit hunters. I'm not bad-mouthing youth hunts, but I'm wondering, I mean, it sounds like it ought to work, but do we really have any data to back it up and say, yeah, we got more young hunters into the system because we let them hunt 2 weeks before the season started?
We don't have any real specific data that would hint at that. We do have, I mean, we could look at our hunter numbers. You wouldn't be able to directly tie that to their experience with the youth hunt and see if that's how they were recruited. But, I mean, overall support for that program seems to be really high. And every year you hear lots and lots of stories of youth who have had amazing experiences on that youth hunt. So it's something that we continue to support, although we don't have any direct data that would support it. Otherwise, it's just anecdotal evidence from it.
Well, I'm not saying I don't support it. I do support it, but I'd like to see some data or something that would back it up, because if we're just letting them hunt with their dads 2 weeks early, that's okay, but let's say what it is, what it is, not something else. I have another question about rest areas. It's something that's been on my mind for 30 or so years. Is there any thought to expanding rest areas outside of WMAs?
We haven't really thought much about that, largely because, you know, the Great Salt Lake itself is just a huge rest area. It provides ample opportunity for waterfowl to go out there and loaf and really be undisturbed for the most part. And so it's not something we've really ever considered.
Well, that may be so, but there's very little of the waterfowl use areas that isn't easily accessible to airboats and to mud boats nowadays. And it's my experience that whenever you drive your airboat through an area, the ducks are not able to rest very well.
Yeah.
So it's something I've thought about for a long time. Is rest areas are probably the least thought about thing in the whole management process. And I was devastated when they opened the rest area in Ogden Bay, for example. So it's a question I think you ought to look at, which is not a question, it's a statement, but nevertheless. That's why you don't have a microphone. I'm the only one that has one. I take up all the time.
Additional questions from the council? John Blaser.
I was just curious as to what the long-term waterfowl hunter numbers are. Are they increasing dramatically or going down? Or
You know, it really depends on the year. It's like everything else. It kind of fluctuates. In periods when we have really good duck numbers, lots of water, hunter numbers usually go up. When the waterfowl numbers decline, hunter numbers tend to decline. Overall, I think just hunting in general, there's been a gradual decline in just the hunting public. It's something that, you know, we want to maintain as many hunters as possible, and so that's why we included it in our plan, just to try to continue to reach out to you know, both old and young alike, try to recruit people and get them interested in waterfowl hunting.
Thank you. Additional questions from the council? Seeing none, we'll go to comments from the public. I don't have any blue cards on this agenda item. Is there anyone who'd like to comment? Okay. Make sure you fill out a blue card for me.
I appreciate it. Jeff Richards, I'm president of the Utah Waterfowl Association. And I just want to comment, want to thank Justin Dolling for putting this plan together and taking the opportunity to put all of the different hunting organizations, or the waterfowl organizations, and other stakeholders that were involved in this in the committee and taking a lot of public input. We think this is very thorough, well thought out, and just want to speak in support of this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else from the public who'd like to comment on this agenda item? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Comments from the council. Jeff.
I just
wanted to back up what Jeff Richards just said, because Justin stepped up and took on this feat, and it was kind of like herding cats at times, I'm sure. But it came together with a nice little agenda that I think the DWR can follow, and it's a pretty good guideline for keeping things on track in our waterfowling world. And there's, I think my comment is, you know, thank you, Justin, for putting this together, but thanks for bringing so many different stakeholders together, because it came up with a pretty good agenda.
Joel?
Yeah, just a quick comment. I want to kind of mirror what Jeffrey said, that it's as a waterfowler myself, it's neat to see this management plan as an objective, kind of as a goal and a guideline, so that we have some direction that we can head towards. As I like to say, that, you know, ducks don't care once what side of the fence they're on. If there's water there, they'll go to it. And one comment that I would have too is in this overall plan, we're not reinventing the wheel here, but I think that the utilization of conservation easements would be a great management tool on this, the habitat management section, as well as in addition to land acquisitions and working with adjacent landowners. I found that to be very beneficial. So,
any additional comments from the council? Seeing none, chair would entertain a motion.
I would make a motion to accept it as presented to us.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a motion from Jeffrey Hicks and a second from Joel Ferry to recommend the Wildlife Board adopt the Great Salt Lake Waterfowl Management Area Management Plan. Acceptable to you? Okay. Okay, we'll have discussion on the motion. Justin would like some clarification.
Hey, I just need to provide some clarification. With these management plans, they typically don't go through our wildlife board. They go directly to our director.
Okay.
So that's just a clarification.
So the director will approve it or adopt it as your management plan. Is that correct? Okay.
But you can make recommendations to the director.
Okay. So...
recommended.
Okay. Okay. So the motion would be to recommend the director of the Division of Wildlife Resources to adopt the Great Salt Lake Waterfowl Management Area Management Plan as presented.
Well said.
Yes, okay.
It is acceptable.
All right. Okay. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we'll have a vote. Please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
All in favor? None opposed. Passes unanimously. We're going to take a quick 10-minute break, and then we'll come back.
I thought that's where it went, but I guess not.
Well, I haven't quite figured out what that going anyway thing means yet either.
The thing that we want to win.
I'd like to.
For the next agenda item, Pine View Reservoir Hunting Closure Proposal is brought to us by a landowner adjacent to the reservoir. Mitch Lane from the Division of Wildlife Resources will introduce the agenda item. Mitch, you can just come over here, and we're going to be going back and forth between you two probably. So.
You're that or just...
I'm Mitch Lane, a sergeant with the Division of Wildlife Resources. I supervise the officers in Weber, Box Elder, and Cache counties. Becky Wood is a Huntsville resident. She lives next to Pineview Reservoir, and she's going to make a proposal tonight regarding hunting activities and possibly the closing of such activities on Pineview Reservoir. We'll let her give her presentation or proposal. Then I'll come back, answer any questions, and give the division's position on her proposal. So, Becky Wood.
Thank you, everyone here tonight. I'm very grateful to be here. I'm very scared to be here, but Huntsville is near and dear to my heart. Our family moved there in 1860 with Jefferson Hunt, Charles Wood, and... and we've been in that valley ever since. As a matter of fact, we're the only descendants of Charles Wood that remain in that valley, my sisters and I. And we treasure Huntsville. It is a beautiful little spot, and to us, a sacred spot. And I don't want to make this like an anti-hunting proposal. I personally don't like to hunt, but I don't want to come here with that as the focus of what I want to say. When our dad built our home in Huntsville back in the late 1950s, there was no such thing as the Pine View Recreation Area. It didn't exist. The land that was in back of our house, which is immediately adjacent to the south finger of Pine View, that was farmland. People grew hay there. And when the farmers cut their hay and were all through baling up, my sister and I would run down in those huge hay fields and gather up the little ribbons of excess hay and build a big haystack and run down and jump in it. It was a one-jump thing. It wasn't like a trampoline where you can keep going, but it was so much fun. But in the Huntsville was fun. It was a fun place to grow up. In the early 60s, the federal government came in and realized what a beautiful treasure that little valley was, and forced the landowners to sell their fields and the homeowners to sell. That's why there are apple trees in the Jefferson Hunt campground, is because private residents built them. They had homes, planted them. They built their homes there and planted these trees. That's why you can still pick an apple if you go down to the Jefferson Hunt campground. And that's why the trail going into that campground is called Winter's Grove Trail. An old man who our parents always called Old Man Winter, lived there, and that's who the trail is named after. It's a unique spot, and Huntsville is a unique place because we're this little peninsula of land that juts out right into the center of Pine View, and yet we're an official town, a community. We're not just some random cabins or vacation homes, even though there are a lot of vacation homes there now. They're not like cabins or places people just come to occasionally. We live there full-time. We're full-time residents. And the Pine View Recreation Area has become our next-door neighbor. However, a lot of the rules and laws that apply to Huntsville and the residents within the town and community of Huntsville, there you go just one step beyond that fence they put up when we were kids, which was a wicked fence. It had barbed wire across the top of it, and it's right on the edge of our lawn still. Aren't the same as the rules we have to abide by in town. The rules we have to abide by in town would say that you couldn't let a noise travel beyond your property line, or that's a disturbing the peace violation. You got to keep your noise within your own yard. Now, on Pine View, people go out there, turn up their radios, and zoom around, and we can hear it in the town. The hunters aren't they're not crossing any legal lines or boundaries. It's totally legal to hunt in that area. They but the noise that their guns make do cross a boundary. It does come over into the town and into our community. Clearly, on a clear, still day, fall morning, I wake up to gunshots quite often on a weekend, and it's disturbing to wake up to that sound. I don't like the sound of gunshots, I'll be honest, I don't, but they're in their legal rights to fire a gun, and recreationally they can shoot there. A friend called from Middle Inlet who saw the paper, the letter I introduced to the paper, and they printed it in their letters to the editor talking about noise coming from Pineview, who told me that the birds in Middle Inlet were nesting in the shallow water over there, and some kids had decided to go skeet shooting right next to them and had done it for over a week. And every time, of course, they fired their guns, there go the birds. And she was concerned about them not being able to raise their families in peace. I don't think that should be the case. I think the birds have a right to. I think they have a right to raise their families. And I don't think that right should be superseded by a person who enjoys firing a gun. I don't think that my right to walk down into the river bottoms on a fall afternoon or morning and enjoy the beauty that is so obvious all around you should be postponed because I heard someone fire a gun there. I think this year, the water in Pineview, for some reason, I don't know why or who regulates this, back in the old days, the water in Pineview was controlled by one man who lived over in a little house right by the dam. And my mother, who told everybody what to do, called him up one day and said, "You're letting too much water out of Pineview." And he said, "Lady, have you seen the snow on those hills back of the house?" It was just his decision to do that. So I don't know who's in charge of that now. But this year, the water receded in Pineview quite rapidly. It usually stays to its fullest capacity until about after the 4th of July. And this year, it came down, I would say, about the first part of June, they started to let the water out. And what that did was create a marshland. And it also stopped the boats from being able to come up into that area at where the birds are. They like to stay in the shallow areas of the lake. And it also stopped the boats from coming near our homes with the noise they make. And I thought, this is a win-win. It's good for the birds. It's good for us. If the water levels of Pineview are lower and you make this like a wetland, like a reserve, or I don't know the terms to use, but an area where hunting isn't allowed or recreational shooting, that would disturb those birds. And that's my idea, and I hope you agree, and I'm very grateful to be able to express that idea to you, and thank you very much.
Becky, before you sit down, could you just clarify the area that you're asking for a hunting closure so I understand it correctly?
You know, that the river bottoms, the area we call the Huntsville River Bottoms, are directly in back of the home where I live on the south end of Pineview. But I understand that technically hunting is allowed out on the lake and or shooting. If you want to be in a boat out on the lake, I understand that's legal too. The areas nearest to people's homes, see, Huntsville is the community that has the most exposure to Pineview. The most people live in that area. As you get towards Eden, there's just houses here and there. But Huntsville, on all sides of Huntsville, we're surrounded by Pineview. My first concern started to be just the river bottoms in back of my home, which is an area between about 7500 south, if you drew a line out into the water, 7500 south to about 6800, you know, as you go west. And that encompasses the river bottoms, which is where I hear the noise from. But then that lady from Middle Inlet called me and said the skeet shooters, these people skeet shooting, were in the little area where she lives. That is Middle Inlet, and I don't know the addresses over there.
I just need to know a boundary. If you want to say all the Forest Service land on Pine View, or if you want to define it within a certain distance of Huntsville.
Yeah, like a buffer zone. Except it's just all the Forest Service land in the Pine View Recreation Area that surrounds Huntsville and that one place in Middle Inlet. I don't know. Okay, the whole Pine View area.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Mitch?
The division agrees wholeheartedly with the value of Pine View and the wildlife that use it, and I certainly sympathize with Becky with the issues that she has. However, the division does not support this proposal. There's several reasons, which I will now go over. The first one of which is a Utah code. It's 76-10-508. This is the one that prohibits the discharge of any firearms within 600 feet of any buildings, as well as other places. But in this case, that would address Ms. Wood's concern there. We feel like that covers that concern. There are areas at Pine View where hunting can occur safely and legally, considering that statute that I just quoted. I've either worked in Weber County or supervised officers that work there and worked with them for 16 years. To my recollection, we have not ever had any other complaints of hunting. It's a small group of hunters, small number of hunters. We feel it's a short duration. The waterfowl season is 107 days. Most of this hunting activity that occurs at Pine View is late season waterfowl hunting, which even shortens that duration even more. There are no biological reason why hunting should be closed at Pine View. The division is concerned a little bit with what closing an area like this could do as far as setting a precedent for other type requests and proposals. And in closing, I can assure Becky and all the residents in Huntsville that the Division of Wildlife will respond to and handle complaints of violations. We work very closely with both the Weber County Sheriff's Department and the Forest Service law enforcement officer up there, and I feel like between those two agencies and ours, we can efficiently address any true safety concerns that might arise from otherwise lawful hunting activity at Pine View.
Thank you, Mitch. We're just going to follow our standard procedure. Becky, when we get to the comments from the public, you can definitely comment again, okay? So, to reinforce your position. But we will have a time limit on those comments, okay? So, are there any questions from the public on this agenda item? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Council members have any questions on the proposal? John Wall.
I'd just like to ask you, does Huntsville City Incorporated, or whatever it is, have any firearm restrictions of any kind for the city?
Now, whoever responds, I need to have you to come to the microphone so we can get it on.
I don't think it is legal to discharge a firearm within the city limits.
Okay.
As far as I know.
Jeffrey.
This is a question for Mitch Lane. I just wanted to she brought up the topic about skeet shooting. Is that, seems to me like that's kind of almost a littering issue. Is that legal to shoot a skeet shooting on the shores of Pineview Dam?
If that were prohibited, it would be by a Forest Service regulation. The area we're talking about is owned by the BOR and administered, I guess, by the Forest Service. So that would be a Forest Service regulation, and I'm not aware of such a regulation that would prohibit that. But certainly littering could be occurring, even though the shooting of trap or skeet would be allowed, littering would not be.
Mitch, I'm sure you can inform us on the ability of the Wildlife Board to control the discharge of firearms, which is outside of their purview, I believe. Could you just state what you know as far as being a law enforcement?
To what the Wildlife Board can do regarding...
They cannot restrict the discharge of firearms.
That's
except
correct.
In hunting, right? So
that's
skeet
correct.
Shooting... Skeet shooting is outside of...
Yes.
Yes. It's outside of their jurisdiction.
Yes.
Correct. Okay. Additional questions from the council. Joel.
Question. Mitch, as an officer, wouldn't this be more appropriately addressed with the Forest Service than in this body, this issue? Were they on the land?
Yes. It very well may be. We've been... And as well as Ms. Wood, have been in communications with the Forest Service.
Okay.
They're aware of her concerns. I've visited the area with, one representative from the Forest Service.
Okay.
I can address that a little, too. I know Ms. Wood contacted me, and we visited about this subject, and that's been passed up the line to our district ranger, who's been meeting with the division, and we're actually looking at, is there some signage there that we can better inform folks about some of those concerns. But at this point, when they had a meeting scheduled, that was the same time we had a fire break up in Logan, so that meeting was canceled and just needs to be rescheduled at this point.
Any additional questions from the council? Jim?
Well, maybe we ought to boil it down to what this committee can do and what this committee can't do.
Is it a question or a comment?
Yeah, that's a question. What can we do and what can't we do?
We could make a recommendation to the Wildlife Board for a hunting closure, or we can make a recommendation to the Wildlife Board opposing a closure. It is an action item. So we need to have when we get to that point, we'll have to have a motion.
But we can't do anything with a noise restriction. We can't do anything with a shooting restriction.
Correct.
Okay.
Any additional comments from the council?
Were there questions or comments? Or
questions, sorry. Seeing none, we'll go to comments from the public. And I need everyone who comments to please fill out a blue card, because I don't have any on this. So, okay. So, sir, why don't you come on up and just give us your name, and then please make sure to fill out a blue card.
My name's Scott Anderson. And the thing that concerns me, I live in Bountiful, Utah, and we've got a rifle range on the northeast side of us about 3 miles away. We got Farmington Bay about 4 miles away, and I can hear shooting from either one of those during the waterfowl season from Farmington Bay. So, and we got rifle ranges dotted all over the place. And the governor even asked us to go use the rifle ranges now. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Any additional comments while Becky's filling out her card? Go ahead and make your comments, Becky, and then we'll get that.
Thank you. In the Huntsville River bottoms, there is signage posted by the Forest Service, And on the south, and it's just a small area. It's just about, if you walked four blocks straight, you would have walked from one side of it to the opposite side, and you go down into this natural river basin. Well, on the south side of that trail is a sign describing the types of wildlife and birds to look for in the area. And the very last paragraph of the sign, that's the Forest Service sign, says, don't make any loud or sudden noises. If you want to maximize your viewing of these, of the, you know, of the wildlife in this area, well, a loud and sudden noise is a description of a gunshot. Thank you.
Thank you, Becky. Any additional comments from the public? Oh.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Adams. I just want to make similar comments along with what Scott made. Scott, living in Bountiful, I happen to live between Brigham City and Corinne, out in a rural area, in a farming area. We have a marshland in our neighborhood as well as the Bear River. And then within about 4 miles of our home is the Brigham City Gun Club. So I think that no matter where you go in the state of Utah, whether you live near a larger lake or you live in a rural area like I do in the middle of cornfields, we're going to hear the discharge of guns no matter where we live. It's a large part of our lives. I respect the wishes of this kind lady, but I really feel that it'd be massively detrimental, not only to us as adults, but to the activities we have with our youth and any efforts we're putting forth with them. So it doesn't seem to me that wherever we live, whether we're in the middle of a city or in a rural area, we're going to hear the gunshots. We should skeet all the time and enjoy the wildfowl, whether it be viewing and then during the hunting seasons as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional comments from the public? Yes, sir. Please make sure to get a blue card filled out when you're done.
Kevin Norda. I, too, live in a small community here in northern Utah. I live in Elwood. We don't even have a stoplight, which is nice. But there's not even a law in my town about shooting a gun in the city limits yet. There's just, two pheasant farms around my property, or just adjacent on the Bear River. Unfortunately, I do hear a lot of gunshots. Sometimes I'm a participant in the gunshots. I guess what I'm saying is, along with Jeff, is that you're not alone in hearing the noise. And I think it would be a pretty slippery slope to go down the road if we were to start closing areas just due to noise that can be sometimes heard close or in a distance. Gunshots do at times travel long ways, and so does boats when they drive across the water and they got their radios on. That noise will echo off the water, and there's really not, I mean, it's probably just a sad factor, a sad reaction of people having an enjoyable time for themselves. I do appreciate you, what you've done. Okay. Anyways, that was my comment.
Thank you, Kevin. I'll let
you. The Winter Cross Nature Trail is a designated nature trail. To me, that says you go there to view nature. There's three signs along that trail calling it Winter's Grove Nature Trail. The sign at the end says, be quiet when you come here so you can view nature. These are Forest Service signs. Okay, thank you.
All right, Mick. Thank you. Is there any other comments from the public? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Comments from the council on the agenda item. Jeffrey.
I just want to comment that I am in agreement with the DWR's position on this. I think it sets a dangerous precedent to close areas that are legally open to hunting and reducing our opportunity to hunt, especially based on the proximity to houses that is still legal. And if it's based on gunshots, I think we could go down a slippery slope where we might end up closing so many. There's miles and miles of marshland along Kaysville-Layton area with subdivisions built right up to the edge of it, and I would hesitate to go along with a any proposal that would close up legally open lands based on the discharge of firearms.
Additional comments from the council? Bryce?
I hate to feel like we're teaming up on you. I wish you would have brought some more people so it didn't feel like we were singling you out. But, I mean, banning gunshots, I mean, if we're disturbing wildlife, we're going to have to ban people that drive around Pine View, boats in Pine View, cars or airplanes that fly over Pine View, people deer hunting, you know, 5 miles up any hill around all of Huntsville, because, you know, you're going to hear that. So, I mean, I live in Perry, and I can hear guys probably out at the Millionaire opening morning, you know, shooting ducks. So, unfortunately, I mean, the cars are a lot louder on the freeway than the shotgun. So, I kind of hope we totally avoid ever going down this road and not even give it a consideration. So.
Any additional comments from the council? Paul.
Hey, Becky. I just wanted to say thank you for taking the time to come and express your opinion and voice that to us this evening. I think it's really commendable, you know, that you took the time to come and try and address an issue versus letting it just fester and struggle with it that way. But thanks for taking the time to come. And I know with our staff, we're trying to work with the division to figure out, you know, how do we best balance out some of the needs as we get communities on top of residents and marshlands and various activities. But thanks for coming this evening.
And my comments would be that we respect private property rights and the property rights of the land management agencies in Utah, and very much so. Currently, you don't have a recommendation in favor of this from the agency that basically controls this property. We can't do anything about people just discharging weapons that are not engaged in hunting. It's outside of the capacity that we're granted by the legislature. They hold that very tightly in their hand as far as shooting that's not involved in hunting, okay? I'm glad that you came out and tried or that you've came out and made your presentation and become involved in the process. We need more people to be involved in the process of managing wildlife in Utah. Okay? So, any other comments from the council? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion.
I move that we, as a RAC, recommend to the Wildlife Board that they not accept this proposal.
Second.
Okay. Okay, we have a motion from Jim and a second from Craig to recommend the Wildlife Board not adopt the hunting closure proposal.
Close enough.
Close enough. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, we'll have a vote. All in favor?
Bruce,
yes?
I'm kind of looking at the Forest Service having representing another federal agency, and I'm inclined to withdraw from this particular issue because it appears to be very direct to Forest Service lands. But so I think I'd like to withdraw.
You'd like to recuse yourself because you have a perceived conflict of interest? Is that
perceived is what it may be.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, and certainly that's something you can do. I think that what we can do, however, is we can recommend
that there be a hunting closure or recommend that there not be a hunting closure. The Forest Service can do what they want to do, regardless of what we do. So certainly you're welcome to excuse yourself from the discussion, but I don't think at this point we prohibited or encouraged the Forest Service to do anything. We can only do what we can do, which has to do with strictly hunting and not land use in any other way.
Thank you. That actually helps out a lot, because really what we're doing is recommending maintaining the management of wildlife as the DWR has done in the past.
It is.
That's correct.
Are you still going to want to recuse
I'll
yourself?
Go ahead and vote then.
Okay. So, any other discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we'll have a vote. All in favor, say aye, please, and raise your hand. No opposed, so it's unanimous. Thank you, Becky, for coming out. Okay. Now, you will still be on the Wildlife Board's agenda, okay? So, okay. All right, thank you. I'll be there. We'll go ahead and go on to our amended agenda item. John? Give your coyote control program presentation.
I have a question before he starts.
Yes.
Is this an action item?
No, these last two that we added are informational only.
Okay, I just want to make that clear.
Whenever you're ready.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and then so this program has been sort of a new, rather rapidly developed program. So it's been something that there's been a lot of interest in, and so the other RACs have asked me to, since I was available anyway, just to give a little rundown of where we are in this and how this is developed and what's happening with it. So I just put together this short presentation to try to pack in as much information as I can briefly for you, though. So a little background, predator management in Utah has historically been relatively aggressive. If you look at the numbers last year's, we tend to spend more or as much as the five neighboring states combined. The thing that's interesting is what's going to happen this year. If we add in what we're going to put on this year, it kind of goes off the chart. It goes up to $1.1 million spent on predator control in Utah in this current fiscal year. So that's being bumped up considerably. Now, the reason we're having this discussion, there are two bills put forth by the legislature, one sponsored by Senator Hinkins. It's the predator control funding. And this is the one where it's added the $5 fee to our permits for a big game. And then the Mule Deer Protection Act was sponsored by Senator Okerlund. And this is the one that requires the DWR to reduce coyote populations for the benefit of mule deer. And it's very specific in its recommendations or its demands, I guess, that we go through and work in areas to help mule deer by removing coyotes in those places where coyotes could be impacting those populations. And it sets up a mechanism for us to do that. That is, that it authorizes us to contract with members of the public for these coyote removals. The way the funds are going to be spent, the predator control funding is portioned out to Wildlife Services for targeted control. So this is going to continue as it had in the past, where we contract out with Wildlife Services. They use their helicopters and their specialists to go in and remove animals, especially in places where the mule deer herds are impacted. The Mule Deer Protection Act money, though, this is the $500,000 that is going into the general for public contracts, and this is the one that most people are talking about or thinking about, the $50 a coyote money. The approach is actually twofold. The law actually sets it up to create two different mechanisms for paying people to remove coyotes. One is a more general program, the one people are thinking about. This is a general predator control program, and it contracts for coyote removal from the general public. That's already up and running and starting this year. This is the one where people will show up, turn in a coyote, and then $50. And I'll talk a little bit more about the details of how that happens. Then there's the targeted predator control program. And this is the other part of the law that says that we will contract with specific people to work in specific areas as contracted vendors that will remove coyotes from areas where we need them removed. And I'll talk a little bit more about this, because this will become important in how we set up the program. So it's not ready to come online quite yet. It'll probably go into effect next year. Relative to the biology, we try to make this program as efficient as we can and as effective as we can, because of course it's for helping mule deer. That's the intent here. So we're recommending people that they target removals where it might have the best impact. That is where people can turn in a coyote from anywhere in the state, but we did produce a map, and we are recommending that they work in areas where there are mule deer, where there are deer, where there are fawning grounds, where the coyotes are likely to, they might have an impact. And we're also recommending that they do coyote removal when it's most efficient in terms of coyote populations and their effect on the deer. So that is, we're recommending that it's removal is after coyote social groups are stable and before pups are produced. So again, that's that December, January, February into the fawning season time frame. The idea is that if you hunt coyotes in the late fall, that's when they're dispersing, they're moving. A coyote that's removed from a particular area may or may not be there in the spring when fawns are there, so it'd be inefficient to remove that coyote. And also, that's when they're most likely to die of other causes anyway. So the best bet is to do it during that December, January, and we're recommending that people do it then. So in terms of recommended locations, we put together a pretty basic map. When people log in to join the program, they can print this out, and they can see more or less where our deer herds are and where they should concentrate. But it's a fairly general map at this point. We haven't really targeted specific areas for people. This is to help get them thinking about where to go, though. In order to participate in the program, we tried to make this as easy as possible for people, but at the same time gather good information and be responsible in how we're administering the program. We require that people register first, and during that registration process, they have to take an informational, I even put little quotes around test there, because basically it's a paragraph, and then about providing information, and then a question right after the paragraph that says, you know, essentially shows that they understand the information there. And then they have to agree to the requirements of the program. They have to produce information like their address, their home address, social security number, and things, because there are tax implications for this. If people do turn in enough coyotes that they hit that IRS threshold around $600, I believe, that we will have to send them a 1099. So we need basic information from them. In order to request compensation, they need to turn in the lower jaw plus the scalp with ears or the whole pelt. I'm hoping people will do it again in the fall, or rather in the wintertime when the pelts are best. That's the best for the coyote population. It's also best for mule deer. And that's also a time when they can have our check in the pelts with us. Then they can still go and sell them as well. So they can get the incentive plus sell their pelts, so if they're in good condition. With the jaws, we want to be able to collect a tooth so we can age the coyotes and get that information about if we're impacting the coyote population. And I'll be taking a tissue sample as well. We're putting together a database now, gearing up to do it, so we can tell if coyotes are from what region of Utah, and certainly, hopefully, tell if a coyote's from Utah or actually from a different state.
that has been imported in. The idea here, as much as anything, is to kind of keep honest people honest and focused on if there's a law enforcement issue that we'd have some evidence to say, wait, this coyote was not from Utah, this is from someplace else. So keep people thinking on those lines as well. The GPS locations are important. One, we need to figure out, are we hitting coyotes? Are we getting them throughout the state? Or are there certain places that we're missing? When we talk about the targeted program, that's going to be very important because we might have places where there's, sort of, where there's a cloud of removal of coyotes, but then there's donut holes in specific areas where people aren't hitting. And I'll talk about that a little more with the targeted program. And if people put they've done all their registration, they're turning their paperwork correctly, then what they'll do, the information we process, they'll get a receipt, and then they'll get a check sent to them as soon as it goes through the system. So where and when to submit, we're recommending that people wait until December. They can collect coyotes now. They can remove them from any place in the state, but we are recommending those specific dates and places. They'll need to hold their scalps and jaws until we're ready. We're hoping for September 1st. We'll start to bring stations online where people can turn animals in. And this has been a little bit of a source of frustration because it's taken a little bit of time for us to get this up and running. But as soon as we know where our places will be, we're going to have them posted online and updated whenever we can or frequently at this wildlifeutah.gov /predator site. There's a few reasons that it's taken us a little while to get this online. One is this is a new statewide program that we've had to get up and running really quickly. It's potentially $500,000 of payments to could be thousands of people. Right now, just about 3,000 people have signed up to the program. So you can imagine, since we have to use state purchasing rules and track everything, we need to have all our ducks in a row, essentially, before we can just run with it. So we want to take care of setting this up. We need to get enough locations that people can turn these coyotes in relatively easily. We don't want anybody to have to travel more than an hour or so. And we're trying to do this without hiring any, you know, great deal of additional personnel. So it's been a little bit of a logistical challenge for us, but we're getting it together. And we'll have these locations up soon. The targeted predator control, as I said, is probably going to start in the fall of 2013. These are the approved vendors, so people need to have a track record for us to be able to hire them as a contractor for this type of work. So we're encouraging people that sign up this year, make a track record, turn in 20, 25 plus coyotes, produce good information, you know, legible good records, and that will get them on a list where we can choose them if we identify places where we need some targeted predator control. I talked about those GPS locations, because if we have those places where we have parts or areas where we're worried about the deer herd, but people aren't getting in there and removing the coyotes, then we can pull from this list of our top hunters, essentially, and contract with them to remove coyotes from these specific areas. Contracts, we'll see how those turn out, thousands of dollars maybe. So finally, one of the last questions is this program going to work? And one of the easiest responses, kind of shrug my shoulders. The fact is, from the science, sometimes predator removal works, sometimes it doesn't work. It's kind of 50-50 if you look at the studies, and there's certain aspects of it. Coyotes aren't the only thing in this system that are influencing mule deer. Habitat is very important, of course. Weather is very important. If we removed every coyote from a fawning ground and had a terrible series of winters, it wouldn't matter how many coyotes you removed, those deer would still die. So there's multiple factors that influence what's going on. Another question happens to be with coyotes and coyote removal. Coyotes, they're really good at making more, essentially. It's a lot of the modeling indicates that if you want to remove coyotes from an area, you need to remove 70% of them for several years in a row in order to actually decrease that population. That's something that's very difficult to do. They can fill in rather rapidly. Is it likely that we'll remove coyotes from the state of Utah? Very unlikely, actually, given this. But if people target and go to certain areas, specific populations can probably be reduced. So we're hoping that this helps. We're hoping that coyote populations will be reduced in these areas where they might be impacting mule deer. We'll hope the fondo ratios improve. We're giving it our best shot. We're trying to make this work as best we can, but I don't have a definitive answer. But that highlights the need to have some good information on this to know after a couple of years if our coyote removals are intense enough and good enough, and if it's actually helped the deer. So that's why we're gathering all this information simultaneously, so we'll be able to answer these questions. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions if you guys have them.
Because this is an informational item only, we will take questions and comments together. And if there's anyone from the public who has a question or a comment, seeing none, the council?
I have some questions.
Jeffrey.
I'm just some general questions as I see this. So to monitor this, the stations and everything, I assume it's going to take some more man hours and maybe even some new employees. The DWR will have to foot that bill, or is that coming out of the money that is being allocated by the legislature?
Right. It's a mix. What we try to do is we try to keep that $500,000 pure, you know, we try to keep it for the intent of contracts with the general public. So we're not hiring gobs of people to do this, and this is why it's taken, it's been a little more difficult. I work closely with Justin and with all of our supervisors, and they've been great, and so they've pulled people off of other things and things and cobbled together FTEs in order to partly fund it from within our own existing funds. The other thing is logistically what you're going to see is not some full-time person sitting at an empty desk all day waiting to collect coyotes. You'll see the set up in each region to try to have, for instance, in the, I'm just trying to think, like in the southeast, they'll have one site open from 5 to 8 on Monday, and then a different city open 5 to 8 on Tuesday, and a different one on Wednesday. So we'll use people, resources, time, and then juggle around when we are able to turn in coyotes in order to make this happen without hiring a whole bunch of new people on that money.
Can I ask more questions? Okay. Is there any closed areas? Is there any areas that they can't shoot and get a bounty? I guess this is a bounty program, right?
It's I think it's more of an incentive program.
Call it what you will.
Everybody has to follow the one thing they'll go through. They'll see they'll have to follow all the fur bearer. We're basing everything, referring everybody to the fur bearer guidebook. So in terms of where you can go, what you can do, you have to follow all the local ordinances, and then all the standard type rules. You don't get any right to go on tribal lands or parks or anything like that. So it's all the normal hunting regular regulations that everybody still has to follow, but they can remove a coyote, you know, turn in a coyote from anywhere.
Oh. I'll save my last one till after him.
Well, you finish.
Oh, all right. My last question. That's probably a pretty simple one, too. I just don't understand. I think it was the Okerlund one where it's targeted in certain or it's targeted to mule deer, right? So what I don't understand is so you pay people to hit them in targeted areas, and if that's it, are those public areas lands or are they private lands? Are we paying people to clean out coyotes out of somebody's private property, or are we going to I just don't know. I just want to see if you clarify.
We're trying to get people thinking. It's a really unique situation for the division because we don't manage coyotes. It's not one of our species. And we don't manage the lands, per se, that way either. We are trying to get people to focus on areas where mule deer, you know, especially fawning grounds. Okay, we'd really like them to work there. And areas where deer populations can be impacted by coyote predation is the way the law is written. We don't make any differentiation between, you know, land, private, public, or whatever. Although we have, and I've talked to our walk-in access person, and we have had some people check in with the walk-in access program and say, hey, can I put coyote on my list of reasons to allow people onto the private land? So that has, in effect, happened. But we're just saying, okay, this is about protecting mule deer. Try to work in areas where coyotes and deer, interact.
John Wall.
Yeah, this is just a comment. I think coyote control is a good thing, but I think that high of a bounty, and I am one of the 3,000 that's participating in this, but that high of a bounty will bring misinformation. I don't care how you're going to track it. I mean, I've hunted coyotes since the early 70s, right out of high school, back when, you know, you could make good money on them, and you add the $50 plus the fur, people are going to, I don't care how honest they say they are, they're going to come from out of states, and I don't know how you can track that, because a coyote has no boundary, especially in the winding downs up here in the north. I mean, they're crossing over. I hunt a few areas that, I mean, a coyote might be in that area one day, he could be in Wyoming the next, or Idaho the next. It is going to bring a lot of misinformation, that high of a bounty, but that's just my opinion.
We kind of ran with what the laws had. I mean, we did. We were just following kind of what we were instructed to do. And we did try to... The balance is, and there were a lot of discussions early on about this, where a lot of people were coming out, we've got to keep people from cheating. We've got to add this and this and this and this. And we could keep people from cheating in a lot of ways and make the law enforcement easier, but it makes it so difficult that people are like, people are already complaining about locations and things. So we have to balance keeping people honest and helping deer against making it, you know, putting up roadblocks for people. So I think we've come up with a really nice thing in between where people have to send out their location. They sign a paper certifying that I've removed these coyotes from these locations. And if they're willing to put their name to a piece of paper saying... That's, you know, it's the best we can do.
Jim?
So tell me about the budget for this. The $5 additional fee is supposed to fund this entire program, or is that just going to fund the bounty and the hiring of the agents, and you're expected to in-house fund the rest of it?
Right.
Or how's it working?
Okay. So the $5 fee is what's gone into, that's going to end up going passed through to Wildlife Services essentially. So the $500,000 that's going to fund this program, that's general fund monies.
So the legislature appropriated $500,000 for
coyote.
The entire program or just for the bounty program?
For this program, for the bounty program. Well, the incentive program. I guess you can call it bounty program. It's sort of operating like that. It's not pure bounty because we are recommending and focusing in specific areas. We're trying to make it, again, for the benefit of mule deer as much as possible. But that's $500,000 of general fund. We're trying to follow the spirit of it and not just hire a bunch of people. And like I said, I've been working with supervisors in order to make this happen without hiring a bunch of new FTEs. And most of that $500,000 is going to go right back into actual work and reimbursements.
So I'd be very upset if you take a fisheries biologist off his job to run this program, or any other biologist, or even law enforcement. It seems to me if the legislature wants to kill coyotes, they ought to give you enough money to do it, and not just enough money to pay the bounty.
Yeah.
Not that you have any control over it, but this is my opportunity to gripe a little bit and express my usual whatever it is I express. But that's just the way I feel. I don't like coyotes particularly, but I think if the legislature says do this, the legislature ought to give you the money to do it. And if they're expecting you to take a person here and a person there out of what's already a very strapped budget, I think that's absolutely wrong. You don't have to answer that.
I kind of want to.
you can if you want. I'm just saying you don't have to.
I acknowledge what you're saying, and from the way we formed this program, it's a lot to do very quickly, and we're balancing competing interests. There's a lot of people that would express an opposite opinion of you're just using this to hire more people and make government bigger or whatever it is. But we're trying to balance it. You know, we've got a really clear mandate in terms of this legislation. We're trying to enact it the best we can without padding or doing anything. We're trying to gather only the information we need to be able to assess it, to see if it's working. And we're just doing our best we can to implement this and make it work as best we can.
Well, I understand that, and I applaud that, and I am pleased with this presentation. I'm just not necessarily pleased with the whole program.
Okay, can I provide a little clarification? What the region did is they have we have a part-time person that's involved in our depredation and nuisance program, so we took that part-time position and then matched it with the money that's coming out of the two bills to form a full-time position. So essentially it's going to help our region from the standpoint that we'll be able to carve the region in half and now have two full-time people dealing with depredation and nuisance and also coyote check-in type procedures. But the other part is that not all the money that comes from the two bills will go to bounty. There's an education component. There's a personnel, obviously a personnel component, and then there's a bounty component. Did that help?
Oh, that helps. But my statement was simply that if they mandate something for you to do, the legislature ought to pay for it and not expect you to piecemeal it out of. I mean, it's not like you got little pockets of money hidden around that you can pull out when you want to. And we all know that. We all know what your budget is, and so I'm just. That's just my statement to the legislature, more than just to this committee.
Okay. I can ask another question.
After me, John. Especially for your contractors, are they? Are you checking that they are, well, most of them are going to be shooting. Some could trap or snare. So trapping and snaring don't require that you can possess a firearm or a weapon. But people that are going to be shooting, are you going to check that they are eligible to possess a firearm? Just like you do when I buy a hunting license, I have to sign an agreement that I am eligible to possess a weapon, and I can't have a weapon just because I bought a deer hunting license.
The way it's currently set up, we'll have to probably think about that. The way it's currently set up, it's set up. People turn in a coyote; they could hit it with the car. What we're reimbursing for is people that have turned in coyotes. So anything up to then, the only thing difference is with traps in the fur bearer regs, if you set a trap, you need to have a ID number affixed to that trap. So we've got, there's a fee there with giving people those. But as far as other stuff, it's really going to be up to local ordinances and things. I don't currently have it set up in the registration to check for that.
So a felon could possess a gun illegally, go out and kill coyotes, and come to you to get money.
That's something I think we'll think about, or I'll look into a little bit more.
Yeah, think about it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's just my comment.
Yes, no, thank you.
Jeffrey, you have a comment. Bryce.
I just wanted to say, let's give the felons a break and let them shoot coyotes. Nothing else, but they can at least shoot coyotes.
Jeffrey.
Oh, they will. Don't
worry. This is just a question. I know it appears as if we're somewhat stuck with this now, but I'm just curious to see, maybe Justin might know this also, is when this was, obviously this had to go through a subcommittee in the legislature, what was the DWR's position on this, on these two bills that spends $1 million of tax money?
Again, I mean, this was passed. These are our marching orders, and this is what we're going to do.
Wasn't no one there from representing the DWR in the subcommittee that recommended this go to a full vote? And if there was it a favorable recommendation for this?
You're at levels above me.
Justin might know.
And I don't know the answer to that question. There were two bills that went through the process and passed in the end, and I know I've heard our director say that 10 minutes before the session ended, he got a text that said the bills are dead. And then 2 minutes later, he got a text and basically it said they passed. So I don't have a lot of detail of what level of involvement we had in crafting those bills or even commenting on those bills.
Okay. Well, that was what I want to know, whether DWR was involved in crafting this and if they had a say in it, but who knows? Apparently not.
Okay. Let's try to wrap this up. John, and then we'll do John Glazer.
As far as I can remember, I took the test online and that, and there is somewhere in there that requires you to the same circumstances if you're buying a hunting license. You have to either answer yes or no somewhere in there that, you know, says yes, you're legally able to do that.
John Glazer.
I was just going to say, I was involved in the lobbying to get this thing passed through the legislature, and we were trying to funnel money into wildlife services, which the $5 thing did, because wildlife services can take care of more coyotes out of a helicopter and airplane in a day than you can collar trap in a lifetime sometimes. But that's kind of, you know, the Farm Bureau and a lot of ranchers and livestock folk were pushing really hard for this thing too. And I'm sure it was, you know, we were thinking a whole lot more of our livestock than we were the deer. But hopefully it will help us all.
Okay. Thank you, John. We'll move on to our last agenda item. Chet? And this is informational. Chet will give his presentation. We'll ask we'll have questions and comments, and then we'll be done.
Chet Young, Utah Houndsman Association. Mr. Chair, Rack, I appreciate you giving me the time to talk about this. I gave you all a list. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. I'm going to skip number one. Last year, there was some amendments made to the Cougar Management Plan that goes for 12 years. And looking through it, we've kind of seen some numbers that aren't adding up, and we'd just like to see the management plan where it's going to be for a 12-year period, 3 years at a time. We would like to ask the division to look at the numbers. I'll just give you a couple quick numbers. One unit, the objective was 8 lions to be harvested off of it. There was 18 lions harvested this year off that unit. It's pretty devastating. The extra numbers come from another unit that there's 12 tags allowed, or 12 was kind of the objective. There was 2 lions killed off of it. So we'd just like to ask the division, and that would be John, to look at the numbers. And now I'll go on to the paper I gave you. Number 2 on the paper, the voluntary cougar orientation course. We'd like to see that a mandatory course. Just, it's a good course. There's some good information in it. With the bears, it's mandatory that you, if you draw a tag, that you take the class. We'd like to see that with the cougars. I'm going to skip down to number 4. The random pursuit survey. We feel that that should be mandatory for all pursuit. If you buy a pursuit tag, you have to fill out the survey and send it back, just so we have more accurate information. We've been going around the state. We've been Tremont and Richfield, Vernal. We've been just kind of all over talking with houndsmen and trying to get the numbers right. We actually made a little book. It replicates what the division has done and asked people to fill it out, be honest about it, so that we have real numbers. It's hard to know how many lions you have. As was mentioned earlier tonight, it's not an animal that you see. So we would just like to ask that it be mandatory to fill out a pursuit survey. Number 5 on here, Clint Meekum has done a lot of lion studies, and the division puts collars on so many cats. Down on the Monroe, they've got cats collared. A lot of them cats are being killed that have the collars on them. So it kind of interferes with the study, we feel. We'd like to see the study be able to continue. We would like to see it illegal to harvest a collared female. That's already how it's set up on the Ochre. We'd just like to see the Monroe the same. To help with the study. And then number six, we'd like to see a GPS coordinates on the location of all harvested cougars. We feel that cougars are getting harvested on units that are limited entry and turned in, kind of like with the coyote deal. We'd just like to see the honest stay honest and get a GPS coordinates on them. Our goal, we're sportsmen. We love to hunt, just like deer hunters and everything. We just want something to hunt tomorrow, and we're trying to do anything and everything we can to maintain that. Thanks for your time.
Yeah. Chet, why don't you just hang out there? Let's see if we have any questions for you. Maybe, is there anyone from the public who wants to ask a question on what Chet just, or a comment? Okay. Questions from the council or comments? John.
I have a question. When you wanted the pursuit tag, your guys with a pursuit permit to report, turn in a report, is that like yearly or how often would, what do you anticipate there?
That would be yearly. Every year after the pursuit season ends. Right now it's a random survey. You get a phone call. It would be the same questions that are in the phone call, other than it would be on paper. I don't know if it's something that the houndsman could help with, using the division's information to help coordinate the paperwork or whatnot. We would just like to see pursuit days and Lion's Creed Boer Day goes a lot into how many lions we have and whatnot. So if every pursuit holder was filling out a book on the area that they're hunting, it would just give us better numbers.
I can see that that would be good. I'm just, it seems to me like the division needs to generate that because I know there's a lot of houndsmen that would forget to do those kind of things after you keep track of all your permits and everything else that you're having to keep track of. That would be something that would be pretty easy to forget unless it was mailed to you or, that's just...
Right. I don't know the full circumstances of how to set it up, but like if you draw a big bull tag or whatever, you have to do your report. Right. Kind of the same case scenario.
Jim Gaskell.
So the division does a phone survey, is that correct? And it's statistically valid as far as all the mathematicians are concerned. So all this would do would be additional, it seems to me, if we've already got a statistically valid survey, probably not much more to be gained from that survey, although, I don't mind filling out surveys myself, but it would certainly be additional cost to the division to do that, and you'd have to implement some kind of a cost $25 next year for a license if you don't do it or some such thing as that in order to make it, really an efficient mandatory survey. So I'm not saying it's not a good idea, and I'm just wondering if you've considered all those ramifications.
Don't they do a survey on the swans every year if you draw? Don't you have to fill out a survey if you draw a swan tag? And if you don't fill it out, you're left out for 2 years. You can't reapply for 2 years. So they do it. I mean, every tag holder on swans has to do it.
Yeah, and I've been in other states where they've done it with turkeys and all kinds of things. But I'm just not really sure that it's cost effective if we get a big enough number from a phone survey to be valid.
Right. This stems back from 4 years ago, I did a survey that somewhat replicated the division survey and asked everybody at our banquet to fill it out. The numbers were so far off, it was comparing apples to oranges. And I'm not saying which one's right, which one's wrong. I just feel that if there's a way to get better numbers, it would be nice. You know, deer, we count them on the winter range, or they're counted on the winter range. There's ways to count your deer, your elk. Bears and lions and bobcats, they're kind of, you know, they're nocturnal. We don't see them. I would, you know, imagine the houndsmen have more contact with bears and lions than anybody in that sense.
And I appreciate that, and I appreciate your passion for your sport, and that you've taken the time to come up with these recommendations. I really do think that it's a valuable contribution. Thanks for coming.
Additional questions and comments, Joel?
Just a comment / question. You know, when this the cougar thing came up, there were some changes that were made from the previous year when we had adopted this long-term plan. And I made the comment that, you know, if we're bringing this thing up, I mean, something's not right within that cougar management plan. If we're having to adjust and change and modify it, I mean, it's been, what, 3 months since we looked at cougars, you know, and you're already wanting to make changes to it. I don't know why these concerns weren't brought up 3 months ago. I'm personally disinclined to make any changes because, you know, we had the opportunity to evaluate it then, and here we are now. So, I mean, what if something changes in the next 6 months? You want to come back and do it again? You know what I mean? So we have these opportunities to do these things, and anyway, that's my take on this.
Right, and I actually have the same complaint today that I had when this was originally made.
Right, and
you know, yes.
And absolutely, the houndsmen bring the concerns that they're over-harvesting in certain areas, you know, and we get the information from the DWR that we go off of. So, that's just my personal concern and comment on this process. So.
To clarify on it, mm-hmm. I'm actually, when I was talking the numbers, I was not asking for any changes to be made to the management plan itself. Mm-hmm. I was asking if we're offering 12 tags on a unit, the average amount of cats over a 3-year cycle, because we're trying to run this in 3-year cycles, mm-hmm. is 3.66 cats. I was asking for maybe an evaluation, just at the division's discretion, to look at it and say, yeah, we might be a little bit out, so that after we go through the 3-year cycles, our numbers are in line, because obviously this new plan is a learning process. If there's something that can better the process without taking away, is all I was asking for. No change to the plan.
Okay, Jeffrey, did you have something?
Oh, yeah. Just a question, and it might be to John, I'm not sure, about the GPS coordinates. If people had to turn in their GPS coordinates every time they harvested an animal, would that really help? Or what was your opinion on that? And would that give you some really good data that you don't have now?
All these things, this process has been ongoing in terms of communication with the houndsmen. The GPS location, the training, there's a lot of really good ideas in what these guys have been proposing through all five racks now. I think GPS could be really useful, and I think it's all these things are, and this is a good time for us to talk. It's kind of awkward at the rack since recommendations aren't out there right now. But it's good for us to talk right now because this next round, a year from now, cougars will be making new recommendations. And I think we'll have some good mm-hmm. input from the houndsmen, and you might see some of these ideas incorporated in the next round of recommendations. And then we'll discuss it as we're supposed to. But I think there's pros and cons to all these things, and it's just going to take some time to work out, you know, the cost to benefit of GPS locations, the cost to benefit of full survey, a census versus a survey or sample. So.
You're in it.
Any other questions, comments from the council? Seeing none. Thank you, Chet.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Yep. Any other business from the council? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion to adjourn.
Move to adjourn.
So moved. Thank you.